From WXXI News, I'm Michelle Faust, and this is Connections Healthy Friday. Imagine you've come to the hospital for a surgery. Everything goes well, and you're sent home with instructions to follow up with your doctor. But within a short period of time, you fall ill again. Maybe it's an infection or pain at the site of surgery. Now you've got to return to the hospital. That's our topic for today. We're looking into readmissions. The subject gets some attention in health reporting because it's part of the Affordable Care Act's attempts to bring down rates of readmissions by penalizing hospitals. You've seen local rates in our healthcare reporting at WXXI.org/ACA and many other stories and topics related to the Affordable Care Act. Today in the studio with me, I have Anna Lambert. Thank you very much. She's a distinguished nurse of URMC and the Associate Director of Cardiovascular and Thoracic Nursing at Strong Memorial Hospital. Thank you for being here today.
Absolutely.
Over the phone, we have Jordan Rouse, Senior Correspondent from Kaiser Health News. We've spoken to him before about readmissions. Thank you for joining us today, Jordan.
Glad to be here.
And Eugene Litvak. He's the President and CEO of the Institute for Healthcare Optimization. Thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Now, Jordan, I wanted to talk to you first because you've done a lot of reporting about readmissions and the rates across the nation. Can you talk to us a little bit about the thought process when they constructed the Affordable Care Act? Why did they include policy about hospital readmissions?
Sure. Well, readmissions and the high rate that's happened in this country, about one in five Medicare patients is readmitted within 30 days of leaving the hospital. It's been a big issue for long before the Affordable Care Act, and it's sort of stayed steady for a while. So this was percolating along, and it was put into a section of the Affordable Care Act that didn't, frankly, get a lot of attention at the time because there were a lot more hot-button issues. But the idea behind it is that, as you mentioned, some of the circumstances when you get for why patients get readmitted, and sometimes it's inevitable, you know, sometimes it's scheduled, but a lot of times it's something that might have been avoided. And so the idea behind this was to counter what is sort of a perverse financial incentive that hospitals have. Right now, they get paid a set fee for taking care of a patient, so they don't get anything more if they stay longer, and they don't have any repercussions for what happens afterwards. That's just the way Medicare is set up. That doesn't reflect anything on the hospital, but the fact is that their financial incentives are to get you out of the hospital quickly. And if you come back in, they actually get paid twice. So they get, you know, filled the bed twice. So there's just even a financial incentive to, not that anyone is doing this, but to, you know, they benefit from it. So the idea behind these penalties was to erase that. And so hospitals, if they had higher than expected rates, as determined by the government, have to forfeit money in the following year. And that's how this program works. And it's the third year of the program.
Now, has there been any talk to make some changes on the front end instead of leaving things in as penalties on the back end?
You mean in terms of preventing these things from happening in the first place?
Well, you were talking about there being that they're not getting any more for keeping the person longer. So has there been any talk about changing that policy of the rate of pay to hospitals from Medicare as opposed to creating a penalty?
No, it's a great question. And actually, this is sort of, you know, if you look at the history, that's where it used to be. And then, I mean, every financial payment has its own problem, and that's the way it used to be. But then hospitals had an incentive to keep you in, to bring you in, to put you into the bed in the first place. So they didn't want to go back to that. The other thing is that they wanted to be careful, they being the government and Congress, they wanted to be careful not to punish hospitals just because patients are going to be admitted. I mean, if you're 90 years old, you know, it's not surprising that you might end up back in the hospital, especially if you have a serious condition like heart disease. So the idea was, well, we'll wait. We'll see how a hospital's track record is. We'll look at how sick the patients were that came in during the year, and then we'll make it a determination.
Now, so we're seeing that many hospitals across the nation are getting some of these penalties. What are they being penalized for? It's not for all readmissions.
No, right now they're only looking at a handful of readmissions. This year it was five. And these are common things that happen. Heart failure, heart attacks, pneumonia, certain chronic lung problems like emphysema and hip and knee replacements. And those are the only ones that the government right now is looking at. And so they look at those And from that, they determine the penalty.
Now, that's going to have a disproportionate effect on hospitals that specialize. For example, this year, last year, they didn't look at hip and knee replacements. Here locally, we have some hospitals that specialize in that, and they jumped in their rate of their readmission penalty. Are we seeing that across the nation? And then could you also address how disproportionately teaching hospitals are being affected by this?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, what you're seeing in Buffalo is what's happening across the nation, and this is sort of an example of, you know, if
in
you
Rochester.
Look at one area. Oh, I'm sorry, Rochester.
That's fine.
If you look at one area and not another area of what a hospital is doing, you see different things. And so originally, in the first 2 years of the program, specialty hospitals basically got off scot-free because they didn't have a lot of, you know, pneumonia patients or heart failure patients. But now that they're looking there, they are getting penalized, and that's happening everywhere. Now, the teaching hospitals have tended to get hit very hard on these penalties, and that's probably one of the most controversial aspects of this, because those hospitals say, well, you know what? We actually take care of a lot of, A, very sick people that you may not fully comprehend when you calculate these things, and then, B, we have poor patients, and money matters when it comes to readmissions, because patients that have a lot less money are less likely to be able to afford their prescriptions. They might be less likely to go to a doctor afterwards for just to have their follow-up care. They might not even have a doctor. If they live in certain areas of cities or other areas, they might not have as much access to the type of food that you're supposed to eat to stay healthy. And even if they do have access, that, you know, a lot of that stuff is very expensive. Not everyone, you know, can, you know, have a free run through the Whole Foods checkout line. And so they're saying, you know, you, the government, really need to take this into account when you're determining these things. And so far, Medicare has said, no, we will not do that.
Now, Anna Lambert, you work at a teaching hospital. So talk to me about it. Do you agree with what Jordan said? Do you think that maybe we missed something that's particular to us locally?
So, certainly in a teaching hospital, we and a tertiary quaternary care hospital, we are getting referrals from many parts of the region, and these are the sickest patients, and they do, as he said, you know, come in with various illnesses, not only the five, you know, big ones, heart failure, MI, pneumonia, COPD, but it's the social factors that affect their ability to care for themselves and seek medical care, you know, medication management, transportation to the doctor, knowing when to call, all of those sorts of things, absolutely relevant.
Now, I know that we'll be talking in the next hour about poverty and disease, but when we're talking about this situation, I know that URMC tries to partner with community organizations so that people can be linked to some of those things that they need to control whatever the disease that might be bringing them back to the hospital.
Yeah, absolutely. We have what we call a care transition model that we're trying to do that really incorporates many of our regional and community resources. We look at our six tenets, our risk identification when they come into the hospital, utilization of the interdisciplinary team that would include pharmacists, social workers, financial counselors, patient and caretaker partnership, and that's, again, you know, partnering with the patient for do they understand their illness, do they understand how to manage their illness, and to recognize symptoms when they're getting into trouble. Medication management is a huge thing, and there's lots of activities that is going around that, everything from packaging up the medications at discharge specially for the patient instead of in a prescription bottle. They're packaging them as the time of day, so it's a little bit easier for the patient to understand. And then really the big thing is this whole concept of guiding that transition from the hospital back to home to the primary care and whatever. And then lastly, the readmission diversion, so that if they are at home having a symptom, you know, what do they do? Can we loop them into something that will prevent them from being readmitted?
Okay. Now, Eugene Litvak, we spoke on the phone earlier this week, and you mentioned to me that you believe that hospitals could put a little bit more emphasis on how to prevent readmissions while the people are in their first admission to the hospital. Could you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yes. That's exactly the statement I made. And most of the nation and hospital attention is concentrated on what happened after the patient is being discharged. But what is going on at the hospital matters as well. Let me exaggerate to make my point. Suppose that we will discharge patients after 15 minutes of admission. Then it's very likely that this patient, if not certain, that this patient would be readmitted. Why? Because we did not provide the adequate level of care to cure the patient's problem. So what happened at the hospitals today, when the hospitals are full, the decision maker, the managers, executive, they have to make very difficult decisions. First of all, you have the patient coming to the hospital, which is being acutely ill and frequently being paid more for a day than those who are almost ready for discharge. Almost ready, however, does not mean ready. So when the hospital is full and we have to free up the bed, we frequently do that at the expense of those who are almost ready by discharging them prematurely. So is there any solution to that? Yes, there is. If we ask ourselves a question, why hospitals are periodically full and periodically not full, have excess capacity, one would anticipate that that would come from the emergency department patients who can break their legs in unpredictable manner. In fact, that is not the case. Our institute studied multiple, I would say probably well over 100 hospitals around the globe, not just in the U.S., and the U.S. in particular. What we found, that those peaks in bed occupancy are not being caused by patients breaking their leg and coming to emergency department, but rather the way we admit patients electively, scheduled. So if several surgeons would have would operate on the same day and would have a significant volume of patients, that those patients would claim the hospital beds and hospital would become occupied. We found that if we only smooth those elective admissions, not just surgical, by the way, it could be transferred or cardiac catheterization lab patients, we would free up significant number of beds, nurses, and other hospital resources to take care of the patient. As long as this is not the case, we have a problem, because the hospital that does not have necessary available bed would have to choose between the one who is coming in, as I said, acutely ill, and somebody who is almost ready for discharge, and they would frequently make decision in favor of the former, and even would not have time to go after to discuss with patient all the necessary medication and steps that they have to do afterwards. So in the hospital, this problem is curable, but unfortunately, most of the industry is concentrated only on after discharge period.
Now, Anna Lambert, here at URMC, are we taking that into consideration when we're looking at readmissions and trying to prevent them? Are we looking at what's happening during that first admission? We talked about some of that discharge policy, but what's happening for that policy?
Right. So one of the strongest predictor of readmission is a previous readmission. It makes perfect sense, but we are doing the concept of teach back is one of the things that we're utilizing in the hospital to really, again, make sure that the patient understands their illness, understands their medications, understands when to take them, when they should seek additional help, all of those sorts of things, who their community supports are. So we are doing a lot of things in the hospital, you know, connecting them with visiting nurse services, connecting them with there's a lot of electronic helpers available today, anything from medication dispensing systems in the home, iPads that will communicate with a visiting nurse service and tell them when the patient's weight, for example, is up 5 pounds and they might need to take some extra diuretic, things like that. So there's a lot of things that we're doing while the patient is in the hospital to prevent that readmission.
Now, it was interesting, one thing that Professor Litvak mentioned was this situation of being the hospital being at high capacity. To me, that makes me think that the nurses, the doctors, all of the resources that the hospital has, they're all being stretched very thin. What do we do to make sure that there are enough resources for all of the patients? And sometimes the amount of people who are admitted,
you don't have control over if there's, you know, accidents or something.
Right. There's no easy answer to that question, for sure. But I can tell you that one of the things that we make sure that we monitor, one of the measures we can look at is length of stay. And we want to make sure that, two reasons, that we're not seeing shorter length of stays that's unreasonable because of the high occupancy, and vice versa, that we don't want longer length of stays to decrease our readmission rate. So it's a balance that occurs daily of who, you know, how patients are coming into the system and how they're going out of the system. The other really important thing in this is how much of the hospital is being used as the safety net, you know, for the populations that don't have the resources to, you know, have a primary care, and are they using the hospital as their primary care network for their, you know, all of their health care.
Now, Jordan Rao, that's part of the whole point of the Affordable Care Act, is to get less people to be using the hospital as their source of primary care.
Yes, that's right. And a lot of different pieces of it are aimed at getting people more preventative care. A lot of the insurance changes are supposed to make it easier for people to go see a doctor regularly and stuff like that. And, you know, the hospital is pretty much the most expensive place you can be. And so the national trend has actually been towards more outpatient treatments and outpatient surgeries. But the goal is not just to have it happen less in the hospital, but to have all the different parts talking to each other. And that's really it's one of the biggest problems with the current system, is that, you know, say you're a patient and you go from the hospital and you're discharged and you go to a nursing home. Well, a lot of times there's no communication between the two. Sometimes even your records don't go well over there. If you get readmitted from the nursing home, sometimes the hospital doesn't know what happened to you in the nursing home. So there are these two goals. One is to decrease the quickness that people are sent into the hospital and find cheaper ways to do it. And the second one is to have everyone actually communicating, so that a lot of the problems and patient injuries that happen now don't happen.
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned that communication piece, because one of the things I wanted to mention is that one of the things that they're doing is having these electronic medical records and having this communication between all the people who are supporting the patient, and so that all the information about the patient follows the patient. But a survey that just came out just last week was talking about how these medical records, you know, it wasn't looking at how well it's helping. And we spoke a little bit before, Anna Lambert, about whether or not we thought it was helpful. But it's saying that it's taking a lot of time to fill those things out, time that could be possibly better used with patients. Anna, you had a definite opinion about these records, and you told me that you believe that they're helping.
Right. I do think that to set up the program for the very first time, it does take a considerable amount of time and effort to make sure that things are clear and concise and accurate. But after the fact, the benefit of having everyone being able to see the same information, that information sharing, you know, sharing the discharge summary, sharing the anticipatory guidance that the nursing home may need for that patient, is really very, very, very helpful in the care of these patients.
Now, Eugene Litvak, are you seeing this communication factor making a difference as far as readmissions, or is it really too soon to tell?
Yeah, I think, again, it's a little bit too soon to tell. I do believe that it does make a difference, but what I would like to emphasize, that it is important also to have this communication within the hospital. It's wrong to view the hospital overcrowding and the following as a consequential readmission as a snow in Buffalo that just happened and we have no control about it. We do have a control. And let me give you just one example. The Cincinnati Children's, in order to accommodate those artificial peaks in scheduled admissions, they budgeted 75 beds tower with a capital cost in excess of $100 million. One day even, their scheduled admission makes them more or less the same every weekdays, they cancel this project. They didn't build a single bed, and they were able to accommodate even more patients than they were planning with this additional tower. So it is very, very important to understand that we can free up the beds. and our challenge to choose between the incoming patient and the patient who is about to be discharged is the wrong choice. We may avoid this choice by streamlining hospital patient flow. By the way, as a side product, that would be financially very lucrative, as well as would document it to reduce mortality, hospital acquired infection, et cetera, not just readmission.
Now, I wanted to say, Anna Lambert, do you think that having these digital records, I mean, as things go with the hospitals, sometimes communication does get lost, but do you think that this is making a help inside the hospital itself?
Yeah, so we're just really beginning down on the inside of the hospital part of things. But for example, there's something called MyChart that we have available for our patients to sign up for. And for instance, they can get their lab values real time. They can't get everything, not all parts of the chart yet. And there's a lot of discussion about what they should and shouldn't have. But, you know, we are walking down that road of being able to really partner with the patient about their health care. And so right now they are getting some, or I would say most of their lab values they would be able to see right real time, right away, to be able to discuss it.
Now, I wanted to bring up the idea of cost, because we're talking about penalties. We're trying to avoid readmissions. I mean, face it, it helps save lives, because people who are readmitted are at risk of dying. They've gotten a secondary infection. Something can happen. But we're going to talk about the money aspect, because those Medicare penalties are costing hospitals money. Do we have a sense, Jordan Rao, about how much that's costing hospitals across the country?
Well, the total amount is about $400 million this year from Medicare, which is pretty much, you know, Medicare's couch change. It's not a significant amount. For the actual hospitals, it can be anywhere from, it's done as a percentage, and it can be anywhere from, you know, a hundredth of a percent of their Medicare payments to as high as 3%. 39 hospitals, I think, got 3% this year. So it's right in that sort of spot where, you know, it's not driving anyone out of business, but for some people, it's definitely, you know, for a big hospital, it's $1 million. For some, it's $2 million. It's significant money, enough to get attention of the boards and the chief executives.
Now, are we seeing New York on par with the rest of the nation? About 80% of New York hospitals are facing some sort of Medicare penalty.
Yeah, New York gets hit very heavily, and a lot of that has to do with New York City. You know, you've got a lot of teaching hospitals there. You've got a lot of all the issues that we talked about, but it's spread out there, so you do have a higher proportion of hospitals, but it can really vary. I mean, there's some hospitals in just about every community. There's some hospitals who are getting penalized. There's some hospitals that are not. And then there's a range within the penalties where, you know, like I said, some may be technically getting penalized, but they, you know, it's stamp money.
Now, Anna Lambert, when we talk about these readmission rates, when we look at the hospitals locally, how do we feel that we're comparing to the rest of the nation, the rest of the state? When I did the comparison, Rochester was on par, if not a little bit better than other parts of the state. But what are we seeing when we're making those number comparisons?
You know, certainly, I think, and the numbers are public, but, you know, we are seeing that we have some opportunities to improve those readmission rates. And I think everyone is really committed to doing that, because it makes for better health care. We are looking at also doing bundled costs. So a different way of thinking of, you know, not necessarily thinking of inpatient and outpatient, but really the continuum of care of a patient or of a person, and thinking about the reimbursement as a bundled cost. So not only from, you know, for example, for an operation, that you take the preoperative phase, the operative phase, and then the discharge phase is all one particular, what is reimbursed at one rate. So that it's a different way of thinking, and it helps us to be more efficient and hopefully avoid these readmissions by doing the right thing the first time.
Now, when you talk about these bundled costs, how is it helping the patient themselves, or is this really just an administrative issue?
No, I think it helps the patient because we're thinking, you know, just like the patient thinks, they don't think that just the hospital is one aspect, is one single silo of their health care. They really think of it as the whole continuum of seeing, you know, the doctor for the first time, if it's an event, and throughout the stay and through the entire recuperative phase. It, to the patient, it's one thing. It's not the clinic, the hospital, and then the clinic again. It's one continuum of care.
Now, Eugene Litvak, we had talked before on the phone about these readmissions and the dangers to the patients. Maybe you could expand on that.
Yeah, the readmission, clearly what it means that the patient, contrary to our goals and expectations, after the discharge, for one reason or another, the patient is not being cured. That the patient needs to, first of all, claim another hospital bed, and that's a very big issue, in addition to being overcrowded without readmission, hospital become overcrowded with readmission. During the readmission, and when the hospital is overcrowded, that when it's frequently happened, we have other accompanying events, which is hospital-acquired infection, inflated rate of mortality, etc. So the patients definitely are being put at risk, and it's clearly, besides of the financial consequences of that that other speakers just discussed, the clinical, the safety and quality of care consequences are huge. In addition, if somebody is being readmitted and the hospital is full, it means that somebody else will not get the bed or will not get the adequate bed. Now, that's another big issue in the hospitals with admission and readmissions as well, when we have to choose the right bed. The hospitals rarely put the patients in the bed that the patient's supposed to be. Obviously, when the patient is hospital is overcrowded, then the definition of the preferred or the right bed for a patient is the one that happened to be available at this moment. There are multiple studies showing very negative consequences of that. And again, the bad good slash good news is that many of those consequences could be addressed with simultaneous saving.
Now, Anna Lambert, I wanted to mention, because Professor Litvak made a mention of the hospital-acquired infections and that being part of what sometimes creates that readmission. What is the conversation? And there must be a lot of conversation at URMC about hospital-acquired infections and prevention of such.
Right. So yeah, there's really two buckets that the reasons why patients are readmitted. And so, you know, one of them is hospital-acquired conditions. So those are the infections, the unanticipated consequences, the anemias, those sorts of things, usually or more or less related to procedural type of things. But the other bigger bucket is the whole consequence of severity of illness. So, you know, for example, heart failure. You're really not cured of heart failure necessarily, that it is a chronic disease that is ongoing and will have an endpoint. Or, you know, you think about diabetes. You can it's something that's manageable, but it's another one of those chronic illnesses. So it's how we manage those, the severity of illness that is really important.
When it comes down to it, these hospital-acquired infections, they can cause readmission, but what can be done to make sure that we find those before the person leaves the hospital so that they can leave more healthy than they came?
Well, there's various checklists that are available, you know, certainly in a surgical realm, checklists of different clinical outcome measures that tell the clinicians whether the patient's ready for discharge or not. I mean, something as simple as temperature or white blood count or those sorts of things.
So we're doing a lot at URMC. What do you think is the most important factor when it comes to this readmission? I know that's a big question, but
yeah.
What do you think is that biggest factor, the number one goalpost that we've put up, the first thing we need to do to reduce those readmission rates in the local area.
Yeah, it goes right back to communication, and that means communication with all of the caregivers of the interdisciplinary team, and communication with the patient, making sure that that patient and their family members understand how to best care for themselves, and if they can't, who to ask.
We've been talking about hospital readmissions on Connections Healthy Friday. Thank you all for joining us. We've been in the studio with Anna Lambert, on the phone with Jordan Rao, senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News, and over the phone with Eugene Litvak, president and CEO of the Institute for Healthcare Optimization. We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the Affordable Care Act, some of our project, what's been happening nationally. Jordan Rao will stay on the phone with us to talk about that national first week of open enrollment, and then we'll hear from Donna Frescator, the executive director of the New York State of Health Marketplace. Stay with us. You are listening to Connections Healthy Friday. Coming up in our second hour of Connections Healthy Friday, poverty-related disease. Even in Western New York, Americans living in poverty are at a higher risk for certain chronic and life-threatening illnesses. We'll speak to practitioners to identify the problem and discuss possible solutions. It's all coming up in our second hour on Connections Healthy Friday.
The stardom of Benedict Cumberbatch can make you forget he's an actor, a very good one, as in his new film, The Imitation Game.
You need me a lot more than I need you. I like solving problems, Commander. And Enigma is the most difficult problem in the world.
Benedict Cumberbatch later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on your NPR news station.
And you're listening to Connections Healthy Friday. I'm Michelle Faust. You are listening on WXXI, and you can join us online at WXXINews.org. We are going to be talking about the Affordable Care Act for the rest of the hour, and you can get a lot of our reporting at WXXI.org/ACA. It is a multi-platform reporting project entitled Understanding the Affordable Care Act. You'll get national and state news about the health care law and how it affects your insurance coverage. That's online, and it's on WXXI TV and right here on Healthy Friday as well. You can ask us your questions there. Just go to that website, WXXI.org/ACA. You can take our survey or send us an email at ACAWXXI@WXXI.org. We're also on social media. Our hashtag is ACAWXXI. Or you can follow me and send me tweets at MICHE Reports. Joining me for another half hour is Jordan Rao, from the senior correspondent from Kaiser Health News. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Glad you're still here. And I just wanted to ask you, this was the first week of the second open enrollment, and there has been some questions about the national reporting of how many people enrolled. They said more than a million people went to the website on the first day, November 15th, but maybe some exaggeration of how many people enrolled over that first week?
Yeah, I mean, this was an issue last year in that it was very hard to get good numbers, and they weren't really trusted, and you didn't know how many people, you know, followed through. It's a fairly complicated process. So I think that at this point, you know, the best estimate is not to estimate and to hold off. I think that the significant thing that happened this year was that it wasn't the, you know, the massive disaster that it was last year with the websites crashing and people not being able to get on. There have been scattered reports of those problems, but it seems like people are able to at least get on, price some plans and get a sense. And I, you know, obviously you don't have to sign up immediately. You know, people have some time during this enrollment period. And so it's not really until the end of that we'll have a really good sense of how many people enrolled. Last year, there was a surge of people at the very end because, you know, we're all human and we all, you know, work on deadlines and tend to, you know, a lot of people wait till the end. So I think at that point we'll see. But the Obama administration notably lowered their estimates significantly this year about how many new people would enroll. So we don't know if that's sort of just a lowballing political approach to so that they can claim success no matter how many people come in, or if they actually are more pessimistic that new people who didn't sign up last year will sign up this year.
Well, a lot of the reporting and conversations that I've had with some people who really are putting a lot of effort in trying to get a lot of people enrolled this year, they're just not as optimistic about this being a very successful year. The first year you get all the people who are clamoring, wanting health insurance, but there are some people who just haven't had health insurance and they're a little bit harder to reach. Is that the sense that we're getting?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, if you couldn't get health insurance before because under the old system you had a pre-existing condition, you know, you had, you know, cancer or almost anything in your background, so no one would underwrite you, you were very likely to rush in and say, great, I can do this. And likewise, if you were a pro-insurance person, maybe a bit more healthy, but you wanted insurance, you know, those were people who were paying attention. And now, you know, you've got your harder sells, people who may not want to spend the money on the premiums, may not have any immediate health issues that they feel need are addressed, or people that are just not aware that this is out there. And that's a, you know, there's been a lot of polling and other evidence that there's a good deal of misinformation and misunderstanding and lack of understanding among the population. And so those people, you know, they have to be reached out to. But I think you're absolutely right that the second year is going to be a harder slog on this.
Now, it seems a little surprising, and maybe just because of what we do for a living, that people aren't necessarily aware of what's going on as far as open enrollment. A lot of people who didn't even know or still don't even know that there is an open enrollment going on right now. But the federal government and also the state government, they're doing a lot of efforts as far as using social media, using traditional media. There's a tweeting campaign in the state of New York. Really, what else could they do? And is it really just Young Invincibles? Is there another group that's a holdout?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer. I mean, I think it's a little bit of lots of different groups. There have been efforts to reach out, you know, targeting not just different media methods, but also different ethnicities and different populations, people who don't speak English. There are the people that pay a lot of attention to news. And then there are a lot of people that are just busy with their lives and may not be as connected with this stuff. And also, it is complicated. I mean, you have to, you know, I mean, we do this for a living, and you have to really sit down and screw your head on tight to understand all the intricacies. So for people, it's not that easy.
We're talking about our second open enrollment under the Affordable Care Act in the New York State of Health and nationwide. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-844-295-TALK. 1-844-295-8255. I'm on the line right now with Jordan Brow, senior correspondent from Kaiser Health News. Now, you mentioned that some of this outreach is really trying to get some immigrant groups. We talked about trying to get outreach in different languages. There was some problems the first go-round with the Spanish website. In New York State, we have a Spanish language website as well that just opened up this year. Any reporting, anything that you've heard so far as what's being done in second languages and if that Spanish language website is working as well as they're hoping?
I have not heard anything definitive, and I don't know. It's a good area of exploration. My guess would be that places like New York and California, more Democratic-leaning administrations that have, in states that have adopted the Medicaid expansion, which a lot of states, particularly southern states, have not, are going to be a lot more advanced in that and a lot more proactive. You've also got, if you remember, a lot of states that are very resistant. The governors don't like the law. The governor and the legislatures have refused to expand it to people at poverty or below, which was a big part of it. So those people can't get insurance regardless. And so those states aren't necessarily going to have the same efforts that you're going to see in places like New York.
Yeah, and one thing that I've noticed, I looked at the New York State of Health's Spanish language website, and it had similar problems that were reported on the healthcare.gov site when it was the Cuidado de Salud site in Spanish, that it had some translation issues. Are they paying attention to these types of things?
Well, I'm sure they are as they come up. There's a bunch of all the sites have little problems and bigger problems. And obviously, you know, I mean, what we saw with healthcare.gov, this was, you know, the main site. It was just, you know, English. It was aimed for everyone. And there were huge problems originally. So now when you take it and you try and do various versions for different people who speak different languages, you're going to just be compounding the problems. And then plus, since the number of people that are you're targeting are smaller than the whole, obviously you don't have as many resources to deal with them.
Now, New York State, generally, in comparison to the rest of the country, is pretty successful as far as getting people enrolled and how well the exchange has been working. You mentioned that a lot of politics still revolving around what's going on right now with the Affordable Care Act. Talk to me about what's going to be happening coming up in the Supreme Court, because there are a lot of lawsuits against the Affordable Care Act and this process and pieces of it.
The big one, I mean, the House just announced, I think, just a little hour or so ago that the Republicans, they were filing a lawsuit, and that's been expected, and they've been going through various lawyers to get that going. But the big one that's going right now that people are surprised that the court took had to do with a really, really technical line in the law. And that line had to do with whether people who were in the federal run exchanges, these are the 30 plus states where the federal government is running the healthcare exchange, if they're entitled to financial subsidies, if they're of moderate means. And that case had divided a whole bunch of lower courts, and the court has decided to take this. Now, if the court decides that their interpretation is the law, that those people can't get subsidies, that's going to have a huge ripple effect, because a large portion of the people that enroll through these sites, including New York's site, can only afford it because they're getting some financial help. Their exposure is capped. And, I think the estimate is something like 13 million people could potentially lose insurance. So that case is being very carefully watched, and it makes a lot of the people that are the architects of this law very nervous.
Thank you so much, Jordan Rau, senior correspondent from Kaiser Health News, talking to us about this second open enrollment on the national level. We'll be hearing from executive director of the New York Health Insurance Exchange, Donna Frescatore. She spoke with us about what happened in the New York State open enrollment.
The first week, I'm happy to say, Michelle, went very smoothly. Our site opened for the second open enrollment period on November 15th, and it's worked smoothly, and our customer service representatives are busy helping callers with their questions on renewal or joining for the first time in 2015.
No numbers yet?
We're compiling them, and we should have them shortly.
Okay. And basically, it sounds like you said that everything ran smoothly. Any hiccups on the technology at all?
No hiccups on the technology. The technology has worked just fine. People are able to get onto the website, move about. Many people are using our new anonymous shopping feature that allows them to put in just their zip code or the county where they live and preview all of the health plans available to them along with their premium after any estimated tax credit. So that's a new feature of our website that's getting quite a lot of use, and we're very pleased to see that.
Now, do you take any cues from healthcare.gov when you're making plans for open enrollment? Do you look at other exchanges as well?
So we certainly look at our colleagues in other states as well as the federal marketplace to see what has worked in those places, what consumers have found helpful. And, of course, we've listened over the course of the past many months to consumers here in New York as well as our sisters and others about the kinds of features that we could put on our website to enhance the shopping experience.
Now, you said you don't have exact numbers right now, but is there any way to make an educated guess? The federal exchange got 1 million visitors on the first day. Do you think we're anywhere a portion of that?
Well, we're compiling those numbers now, and we should have them for you very shortly.
When it comes to the small business marketplace, that's been open for some time. Do we have any stats on the enrollment and how that's been going?
Our small business marketplace opened on October 1st of 2013, so right on schedule last year. And it's a new option for small employers, which we define as 50 or fewer employees here in New York. And as of the close of the first open enrollment period on April 15th of 2014, about 3,100 small businesses, which covered over 10,000 people, have joined. And many of the employers are finding that the small business marketplace gives them the flexibility to allow their employees to select the plans that best meet their individual needs and the needs of their family, and also makes tax credits available to the small employer if they meet the requirements.
Now, we've gotten some feedback when it came to customers with that survey that was done. Are we getting any feedback from the Small Business Exchange as well?
You're referring to the survey that was done by the New York State Health Foundation?
Correct.
That was, as you point out, Michelle, for individuals and families that had enrolled through the marketplace. We've not conducted a formal survey of the small businesses, but our small business or shop experts work with employers directly and with licensed insurance brokers throughout the state to get feedback. And we're very pleased that we hear from many small businesses that the marketplace is meeting its need to give employees choices. And we find that over 90% of the small businesses that have opted to cover their employees through the marketplace are, in fact, giving their employees a range of different kinds of insurance at different price points.
Going back to the individual exchange that opened over the weekend, are we getting any feedback in the call centers or any concerns or things that people are liking?
Well, we're certainly hearing that people, by and large, are finding the process to renew their coverage for 2015 easy. We've sent over 300,000 notices, very customized notices, to people who enrolled as individuals or families in 2014. And we wanted to make the process for staying covered into 2015 easy for them. So if they don't have a change in their family and they don't have a change in income, we've given them the option to go ahead and continue to stay enrolled in the coverage that they're in as the new year changes. But of course, if they want to make a change, we always encourage that. If they would want to shop, we've made that easy for them. And if they want to make a change, they can do that for 2015. So people seem to be liking the ease of renewal. We're also finding that consumers are using and pleased with the anonymous shopping tool or the plan preview tool that allows them to see more about the plans that are available to them before they start an application than they did last year.
Now, I had quoted you in a previous interview that we were estimating 350,000 new enrollees over this open enrollment for the 2015 period. How does the health department estimate this number, and what are we doing to achieve that goal?
So the estimates come from projections that were done by the Urban Institute before the marketplace opened. And those estimates projected that 615,000 individuals would enroll in the marketplace coverage at the end of a three-year period. And so those estimates are roughly assume that one-third of the people enroll in each of the 3 years during the model period. So that is where the estimates come from. We'll certainly be watching enrollment. You may know that we released information about enrollment both at the county and zip code level, help us better understand where New Yorkers are and who the New Yorkers are that are enrolling in affordable coverage through the marketplace. And we'll continue to do that. Our outreach efforts are even deepened this year into communities. We have a Spanish website now available for people to shop for their plans and complete their application in Spanish. We have hundreds of community events throughout New York State, and people can find those events on our interactive calendar of events on our website. And we'll be announcing new partnerships and events as we move forward through the open enrollment period.
Now, there's been a lot, especially on the national level, a lot of estimations that this next open enrollment that's going on right now will be a lot more difficult than the first round. What are we doing to have outreach to the more difficult to reach populations, the young invincibles and people in rural communities?
Many of our new initiatives are focused on some of the more hard to reach populations. You'll soon see, or starting today, a print ad campaign began that shows New Yorkers who enrolled in coverage in 2014 through New York State of Health telling their stories about how coverage has benefited them. And you'll see that there are a range of people of different ages and different geographic locations throughout New York State. We've also added some new features to our outreach campaign geared at young adults. For example, we've added a texting campaign so that people with smartphones will be able to opt in to receive messages from New York State of Health, including really important deadline reminders about when to enroll, which we found were very effective last year.
Now, I had a chance to look at the Spanish language site right before we got on the phone. I was looking at that, and I was just wondering if there's still some work on updating that translation of that site. I found some of the pieces like some drop-down boxes that were still in English. Is that still under construction?
The translation of the site was of the individual and family portion of the website. There's some other sections of the website that are really geared more towards our sister partners, like licensed insurance brokers and navigators. We launched the site, and we continue to work to review it and get feedback from consumers and others about how we can improve the site even further. I mean, certainly over the course of the last many months since we've opened, this has been a process of really continuous improvement.
And that was my conversation with Executive Director of the New York Health Insurance Exchange, Donna Frascatore. And you can get more coverage about the Affordable Care Act on our new program, Understanding the Affordable Care Act. That's a multi-platform project online. At you can get that at wxxi.org/ACA. Thanks for joining us for Connections Healthy Friday. I'm Michelle Faust, and this is member-supported public radio. We're glad you joined us today.